Hello and welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly and I'm the founder of the UK charity Yes to Life that supports people with cancer in finding out about and taking an integrative approach to recovering their health and well-being. Each week I talk to people working in the field of integrative medicine and cancer to find out more about the latest developments and what's working to improve the situation of people with cancer in whatever way. This week, I'm talking to a doctor with decades of experience of supporting people with cancer using approaches outside of what would be considered conventional, alongside their conventional treatment. Today, I want to speak to Dr. Rajendra Sharma about some very specific topics, so I'm calling him over Skype in the West Country. Hi, Dr. Sharma. Brilliant to have you back on the Yes Life Show again.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Great pleasure.
Right. So today I'd like to go into two topics in a bit of depth, two topics that are certainly of interest and importance to many people with cancer. So these are chemosensitivity testing and something actually we've never particularly focused attention on the show before, heat shock proteins. So starting off with the chemosensitivity testing, I kind of assume that the reason for its name is that it was initially developed as a means to assess which chemotherapy treatments would actually work in any given circumstance. But over time, it's come to be used with many more modes of treatment, I understand, including natural compounds. Do you want to start off by giving us an idea of the range of therapies that the test is used to assess?
Yes, be very happy to do so. You've given me a question that I'm going to go off and find an answer to, which is its history, because I've watched chemosensitivity happening probably only in my memory over the last 20 years. But then I think its access to the tests have been limited to those outside of hospitals and outside of oncology. So it may well have been going on for a long time, and it would be an interesting bit of research for next time, perhaps.
Okay.
But what it's now telling us, I think, is much broader than perhaps we're all aware of. And when I say we, I don't mean just the public, but also colleagues in my field and people from the nutritional field as well, who are also looking into ways of finding answers for people with cancer.
Yes.
The conventional world, as far as I can see, are certainly taking an interest in chemosensitivity, but it tends to be more specific for a particular chemotherapeutic agent, a chemotherapy drug. Because the studies are done by the pharmaceutical industry that are making it. So they want to know whether or not it will work on a particular cancer. Mm. They then fund that, and the hospitals that prescribe it and the doctors, oncologists that prescribe it are very grateful for having such a tool. There aren't a lot of things worse in medicine than providing a drug that's going to come with a whole raft of side effects and unpleasantness if we then find it doesn't work.
Right.
So it's a win-win to be doing chemosensitivity, but the broad aspect of it seems as yet not to be quite as available as I would like, or as we would all like. So in effect, chemosensitivity ranges from being able to test a particular individual or a particular type of cancer against a particular drug, and then across the board. Companies seem to be interested now, these are laboratories rather than companies, perhaps I should say, in looking at, rather than testing a drug against a cancer line, they're now looking at, from the point of view of, send me a cancer and we will test it against all the drugs that we can test it against.
Right.
And more recently, that has expanded into natural extracts and natural therapies of that sort. So when you ask the question, how broad is it, or how many compounds can now be tested. Theoretically, we can test, or I'm not in the business at that end of it, but we can now ask, what drugs can be used? What monoclonal antibodies can be used, which is immunotherapy? And what are chemotherapeutic drugs? Because there is a difference between drugs that can be used, such as, say, tamoxifen, which are small molecular weight molecules that actually work against cancer by blocking receptors, as well as having actual chemotherapeutic agents.
Mm. Well, look, that's very interesting. I mean, is this routinely what's happening, is that it's working the way you've described, is that samples of a tumour are being sent and it's just automatically being run against a huge range of different agents?
No, certainly not routine.
No, okay.
In hospitals at the moment, we are, again, I'm a frontline physician here, I'm not an oncologist. And my terminology and perhaps my depth of knowledge for what may well be available in parts of the world may not be quite what an oncologist would say sitting in my seat being asked these questions. But as a frontline physician coming from a general practice background, my recognition is that somebody with cancer A will be confronted by one of two or three particular protocols based on studies that have taken place around the world. So combination drugs X, Y, and Z may be used for cancer A, whereas cancer drugs Q, R, and S may be used for cancer B. What is happening is that in certain cases, drug X will be specifically tested on the basis of an individual's cancer, either by taking a small amount of that individual's cancer and testing it directly, mm-hmm. or now by using circulating tumour cells, which is becoming more prevalent, as I understand it. Now, that's different from a couple of laboratories that I know of and I use, who are asking us to send in circulating tumour cells, and they then test it against a wide array of drugs.
Right.
Now, this means that somebody with cancer A who would not be offered drugs Q, R, and S may find that drug R or drug R and S are actually of use, but it would never have been thought of because we don't use those drugs for cancer A.
Right.
In other words, somebody with a lung cancer might well benefit from a renal cancer drug, but it would never be thought of or used because studies haven't been done. Mm,
mm.
So it's this specificity that is so exciting, I think, as we move forward, both as frontline physicians and I'm sure from an oncological point of view. Quite whether or not oncologists around the world are very open to the studies to date is a big question, because sure. there's not a lot of studies that I can see being done, and certainly not reaching the first line GP press.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very interesting, and of course that's, as you say, it's quite an exciting thing to do, because it's kind of more generally recognised now the real individuality of each person's cancer, and the fact they happen to have got the same type doesn't mean to say the same treatment is going to work. It could do, but it might not as well, depending on the genetic makeup of the cancer. And so to have an individual test like that, which will suggest something completely left field, that which could, you know, really work, is quite an exciting development.
Very much so, and particularly as we are unfortunately finding that chemotherapy doesn't necessarily have the benefits that we would have liked after the, what must be 70, 80 years of research.
Right.
Starting with things like mustard gas, which really set us off down this path. Mm. We now have such a wide array of drugs. You would have thought perhaps we would be having a marked impact on most cancers.
Mm.
That's just not the case, is it?
No, it's not.
We are having an impact on some.
Yeah.
So now that we are able to also look at other compounds which don't get the research they deserve, because as most listeners to your station and most people interested in this subject are aware, if you don't have the funds to research, you're not going to get the research, and therefore there is a marked absence of evidence.
Yeah.
But as we are seeing a lot of work that has been done in laboratories and perhaps to a degree on animals, are not transferred to human studies, and yet there is an array of herbs and herbal extracts that make a difference. We just don't have the evidence to show it. So if we are able now to show in laboratories an increasing number of tests indicating that curcumin or artemisia have an effect, vitamin C, then we have got, we're opening up the options.
Yes. Okay, look, a couple of things from what you said. This is such a an interesting topic. There's so much to talk about. But just going back to the what you're saying about the history of chemotherapy and its successes and failures, I think, you know, at its best, everyone agrees that chemotherapy kills cancer cells. You get the right one, it works. And and of course, that is something that people are in need of in many circumstances. If they've got a kind of rampant cancer that's out of control, they need something that's going to control the situation. So getting the right one that actually works is a good move. As for curing yourself of cancer completely, chemotherapy on that front is not known for being brilliant. And so I think if we look at it as if we look at it as a way of dealing with a circumstance, it will continue to have uses, especially if we can get it more targeted and actually not just destroying people's immune system for nothing. That would be my feeling. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. There's a big difference between treating cancer and curing cancer.
Right.
And it is such a multifactorial disease that, of course, it has to have a multifactorial answer towards it.
Right.
And along from a therapeutic point of view, we've talked so far about chemotherapy from a conventional and perhaps from a natural extract point of view. We've, of course, also got surgery, radiation. But if we don't look at the underlying causes, if we don't change lifestyle that encourages its growth, or even, of course, its initiation, if we don't understand how exercise and meditative processes, stress reduction techniques, if we don't take all of those into account, we're either going to have recurrence at a higher rate, or we're going to continue to have a high number of people going down with the disease.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge subject, and we do have to look at it very holistically, absolutely.
Right. Okay. Now, another important point that's come out of what you've already said is you've talked about a huge range of different approaches to cancer that we're looking at testing here, the mechanisms of which are entirely different in many cases. I mean, even amongst the drugs, I mean, if you discuss the difference between a chemotherapy and tamoxifen, there's a completely different thing is happening in order to have some effect on your cancer. So I'm interested to hear how one test can bridge all these different mechanisms.
Yes. Well, the test that I most use, and it's worth having a look at if promotion of a particular laboratory is allowed, is the Research Genetic Cancer Centre.
Okay.
They are not by any means the only place doing this. They may have been one of the first to do the broad investigative work, and they're the lab that for me provides the most evidence. And I've been able to learn mostly from them.
Okay.
They have a range of tests which can isolate what tumour we're actually dealing with, which is of interest as we move forward, looking at how best to screen people. Mm-hmm. There are tests that will look at a cancer cell to see whether it can metastasize easily, whether it is good at locally infiltrating tissue,
right,
whether it has multiple drug resistance. And these are all done by looking at the genes within the cancer cell. The tests can check out whether a tumor has a reduced heat shock protein, which we might be able to expand upon a bit later.
Yeah.
Because heat shock protein tells us whether or not a cancer cell is liable to be susceptible to heat. But when it comes to the actual chemo and natural extract sensitivity, it divides the research it's doing at the moment into those natural extracts that have a cytotoxic effect.
Okay, just to make sure everybody understands, you just explain cytotoxic.
Cytotoxic is the ability of a cell to be killed.
Okay.
So cyto is cell, toxic is toxic, and cytotoxicity is the killing of a cell.
Thank you.
By a toxic compound. So are we killing the cells? Or are we looking at blocking their ability to proliferate, mm-hmm, which is done, putting it very simply, by several different processes. And the one that's looked at interferes with the inhibition of growth factors. Therefore, a cancer cell, which would be telling itself and other cells to replicate, there are methods of blocking that process.
Okay.
So it doesn't necessarily kill them, but if they aren't replicating, they will eventually die off. Cancer cells are not immortal cells. They are cells that replicate rapidly. They may have a longer lifespan than one would expect, but they will eventually die off.
Okay.
So if you can prevent their replication, then theoretically they will disappear eventually. We also, within the test structure, see the laboratory is able to tell us whether or not they can stimulate our immune system.
Hmm.
That's not often of much use in the tests that I've looked at, because the number of natural extracts that stimulate the immune system against cancer, the number that they test is quite limited, and they frequently don't show any particular change. Cancer cells, of course, are quite good at hiding, is the terminology,
yes,
from the immune system. They either produce compounds that block the recognition, but we've also got to remember that the cancer cells are actually an initial cell of our own that has altered its behavior pattern.
Right.
So at least in the early stages, cancer cells may not be recognizable from normal cells, so the immune system won't attack. So these three groups, putting aside the immunostimulants, which, as I say, don't generally show up much in the tests, these tests are looking at two areas. One is what kills the cancer cell, what, mm-hmm, is cytotoxic, and what stops them replicating.
Okay.
Similarly to chemotherapy. Not all chemotherapy actually kills cells, but it does interfere with the replication of cancer cells.
Right, right, okay. So in a way, how the particular drug or a compound is doing it doesn't actually matter, because you're testing the result.
To a degree, yes. And that's an interesting division as well, because in the chemosensitivity testing, they do actually measure the number of cells that die off, that get killed.
Okay.
And they allow for a 10% error. And the most successful drugs that they utilize in the lab show up around 90 to 93%, allowing for the 10% error, are being actually killed off.
Okay.
When they measure natural therapy on a cytotoxic effect, they're actually measuring it differently. I'm not quite sure, although I have asked, I think it's me not fully understanding or not perhaps being told in black and white terms that perhaps natural compounds can't be tested and then compared against chemosensitivity because they haven't undergone the same level of research that the chemotherapy drugs have. And putting that into simpler English, laboratories have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars getting a drug on the market.
Mm-hmm.
If we come along and say that we think that bindweed has an equal effect, we'd like to test it directly and see how many cells it will kill in the lab. They argue, well, you can't just do that because, frankly, if we poured vodka onto a set of cells in the lab, we would see 100% death, wouldn't we? It doesn't work that way. You have to look at specific markers. You have to monitor the cell activity. You've got to do it over several different cell lines. You've got to do it with different types of cancers. You've got to do it in different laboratories to show that there's no bias. Whole load of things come into play, which aren't done when one is presented with vitamin C as an anti-cancer agent. So the laboratory has to report it in a different way, and it does so by measuring the increase in a series of compounds called caspases and cytochrome C's. There are many different cytochrome C's and many different caspases. And these are like a domino chain where you one triggers the next and it goes down a line. And as it goes down the line, it kills off the cancer cell. Now, all our cells have this apoptotic, it's called, this self-destructive mechanism. And it kicks into play under gene instruction when a cell is no longer behaving itself or has quite clearly become too old to function.
Mm-hmm.
So we kill off our cells, and we generally do that after they have replicated, and we don't therefore notice a loss in our tissue amount and tissue structure until we're older, when we can't actually replicate at the same speed.
Right.
So children with growth hormone in them, one cell will split into several, and we grow. When we run out of growth hormone and we get into adulthood, we're basically replicating one for one. And then when we reach our dotage, our cells don't replicate at the same rate. And sadly, more cells die off than replicate.
Right.
But that process of dying off down a particular apoptotic chain has compounds in it that are measured. Now, if the natural extract raises the amount of these apoptotic compounds, we can see that the cells die off at a quicker rate. So in effect, chemotherapy is tested by its efficacy on a clear basis of, well, this drug killed 90% of the cells,
yeah,
but natural extracts are measured by the speed with which the cancer cells die off.
Mm.
But nevertheless, both methods of testing are efficacious.
All right. Well, that's very interesting. Thanks for explaining some of that, because honestly, I've always struggled to understand how they could use a test that was developed for chemotherapy on a natural agent. I didn't see how it could possibly work, but you've begun to throw some light on there for me. Thank you. So yes, as you say, well, you say both these things work. Well, you are someone who's got some clinical experience of doing that. So I'm wondering how well the results of the tests are borne out with the success of the therapies that are chosen on the back of them. And in this case, I'm not talking about chemotherapies. I'm talking about natural agents.
Okay. I think my disclaimer has to come into play here.
Sure.
I'm not an oncologist. I'm a frontline physician.
Yeah.
dealing with people with cancer at this level probably takes up about, say, 10 to 15% of my practice.
Okay.
There's an advantage to that because I'm not certainly not an oncologist. I don't specialize in cancer per se. I don't run a clinic that is a cancer clinic. So I look upon myself as being a physician who acts as a hub and advises people down which spoke to travel in this wheel of attacking cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And the point I'm making there is that if you ask me the question, right, you've been using this for several years, and I have, probably about a decade now, where's your evidence? Well, I can't give it. But what I can say is that if I didn't think that a majority of the patients that follow down this particular avenue of getting tested for both chemo sensitivity and natural extract sensitivity, if I didn't feel that that was working better for me than 20 years ago or 35 years ago when I first entered a non-conventional medicine, I wouldn't use it. I can fill my time up with those with other chronic diseases and other conditions that aren't getting better under conventional medicine, which is what the bulk of my practice is and always has been.
So
hopefully, without any particular axe to grind and no clinic to run on the back of people following through with this or any other cancer therapy that I might recommend. And again, let's be very clear, I am not in any way claiming to go around curing cancer. What I do is help people who have the disease take the best avenue. And that is, of course, often and mostly to follow a conventional course using non-conventional medicine as an adjunct or as a complementary aspect. So all those disclaimers in place, I would say that if we take any particular cancer and somebody comes along and has been told that they have a 20% five-year survival or an 80% five-year survival,
mm-hmm.
I think, without official audit, that the majority of people who follow an integrated approach tend to fall into that category of the 20% or the 80% five-year survivor. So turning that into a simple statement is that I think that when I see people, they tend to do as well as they would be expected to do if they follow an integrated approach. And that again brings us back to the earlier comment that it's not just about saying, well, if you use curcumin alongside your chemotherapy, you will do better. It is about looking from the real roots and the base of the problem, the lifestyle, the dietetics, the psycho-spiritual aspect, the exercise regime, the naturopathic extracts that can go with it, and the best chemotherapeutic option if the oncologist will follow the advice of these chemotherapeutic tests. They are doing it in hospitals for individual drugs based on the worldwide research. They are not, as a general rule yet, going off-grid and using things that are showing up on the tests that aren't already accepted.
Right. I see.
Does that answer your question in a roundabout way?
Well, yeah, it does. I didn't expect you to come up with some great statistics, but I did want to get a feeling for, your confidence, I suppose, in the test as a means to reaching satisfactory solutions to really genuinely helping people and diverting them from wasting resources on things that don't work.
Yes. Well, that's always been the problem for all of us, at whatever level, whether we are dealing with the problem or whether we are treating the problem, whether we're a patient or we're a doctor. 20, 30 years ago, I had shelves, and I'm sure you still have, shelves of books that tell us what might work for a particular cancer.
Right.
Some of the better books were compilations where we had experts from around the world who worked in specific areas, whether that's prostate cancer or colon cancer, and they would take us down their avenues based on their research and their experience. And I think we're able to move away now from having to base it on individual research, which may or may not have been somewhat biased. I think if you 50 years ago ran a clinic for lung cancer, you were going to promote your successes and not necessarily your failures.
Right.
Whereas now, and also you'd be aligned to a particular therapeutic program, and that's what you did. And it was effective for some and perhaps for many, or not for some and perhaps not for many. But nowadays, I think we can be much more pinpoint and accurate, because if it works in the lab, it doesn't necessarily mean it will work in you, but it is more likely to work in you. Right. If it doesn't work in the lab, then we can feel fairly confident it won't work in you.
Right.
So of the choice of 50 different things that we might start with, if we best guess, we can narrow it down to a dozen or half a dozen sometimes that have worked in the lab. And therefore, that's not a bad place to put your time and money.
Right, right. It's a much better starting place. Okay, well, look, talking about the money part of it, so once you've got the debate about how useful they are done and dusted, the next question is about making financial sense of testing, because some people have got a very limited budget. So
yes, absolutely.
So first question is, I'm interested to know, has the price come down at all as the test has become more widely adopted?
Yes and no.
Okay.
The lab I use mostly has kept its prices stable for at least for the last 7 years. And I think that in itself is commendable.
Okay.
Other laboratories are springing up around the world. The one I use is in Greece. There's certainly one in Germany. There are a couple in the United States. There are probably those I don't know about in the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
That said, the RGCC have, when I first was introduced to them, they had offices in 7 countries, and I believe the figure is now in over 30 countries. So that means that there are more and more doctors, either like myself or oncologists, who are using the test, and they're being able to expand, and hopefully those prices will come down.
Well, hopefully.
Other labs are coming in with lower prices. But according to RGCC, they're doing different tests. Now, I'm not an oncologist. I do my very best to keep up with the very, very intricate science that goes on. But the tests are very different. So firstly, we haven't yet had comparable studies between the different tests. Some are less expensive and have their place, and others have been around longer, but are more expensive. But I think things are moving in the right direction, right. And they certainly will as competition increases.
Yes, yes. Okay, so when you're weighing up the choice of using this form of testing, some of the important points to take into account could be, well, if saving money on testing means the likelihood of successful outcome is decreased vastly, i.e. you don't pay for the test, but you don't have success, then it doesn't make any sense, unless it's simply not an option to you. So if it's a given that the test is really dependable in that way, then it starts to just look sensible to do it. Another point would be that investing in a test at the outset, it could actually mean a saving of costs in the long term by avoiding paying for stuff that would never have worked in the first place.
Yes.
Another one is that testing could indicate therapies that are not in themselves affordable for the person, partly at least, as a result of having paid for the tests. So it's quite a conundrum. Can you just help maybe see our way through this a bit, looking at it from the perspective of, let's have three sample people with a range of resources from kind of stinking rich down to very hard up, and how it makes sense to them, given those circumstances?
Of course. One of the points that you said there was, can it save you money? And the answer is yes. I have quite a lot of people who come to see me asking for vitamin C therapy, for example.
Yeah.
This needs to be given intravenously, and it is expensive. Depending on the individual and on the number of infusions that are needed and the course, you are unlikely to walk out of any centre in this country not spending at least £3,500 to £4,000
Sure.
by the time you've paid for the infusions, you've paid for the necessary tests to make sure that it's safe and you're well through the course, and you pay for fees where appropriate. Now, if the test costs, and the test can cost anywhere from £1,900 to £2,500, depending on whether you just do the natural extracts and whether or not you include within that the other costs of reporting. So this means that some people will some clinics, some doctors will have the test at £1,600 and then add on everything else, like the courier costs, the reporting costs, or the revisit and so on, or whether it's all lumped together. But that's the sort of ballpark figure you're looking at. Now, that for that, you have to have and be able to afford it, whether you, as you said, you're stinking rich, or whether you choose to put your money towards that. However, I don't encourage people to go through the vitamin C therapy without doing the test.
Okay.
Because if the vitamin C therapy isn't working in the lab, you've saved yourself £4,000 and 2 to 4 months worth of time, which you may or may not have.
That's important.
Secondly, if you best guess and then you then have to best guess 3 to 6 months later, you are still going down a somewhat blind alley, perhaps not with the time that you would like. But if you've got the test, you're actually likely to map out 9 to 12 months of rotational treatment, because a good way to fox cancer cells, which have a tendency to develop resistance, mm-hmm. is to keep changing the treatment.
Right.
So armed with 12 extracts, plus or minus the chemotherapy, small molecular weight molecules, or immunotherapy, armed with all that, you can plan out an attack that's going to keep the resistance at bay. So I think that if you've got that sort of funding, if you can afford the test and then you can risk having a £4,000 charge for treatment on top of that for the first 3 months, and then you may do lesser costs as you go forward, because vitamin C tends to be at least one of the most expensive therapies.
Mm-hmm.
That's the deep end of the pool. That's the one for people who can afford. Those who can't, well, the more people who do the test, the more we are learning which compounds come up more frequently.
Yes.
And for those in the shallow end, those that can't afford, who choose not, therefore, to follow down the vitamin C path, because that would mop up the funds that you might have for a dozen other therapies for a year, you can look at things like Artemisia for a couple of £100 a month. You can look at Agaricus blazei murula mushroom extract for £90 a month. You can look at curcumin and quercetin for at high dose for a couple of £100 a month. And you may only do those for 2 or 3 months, and you can cut the cloth to suit the pocket,
right,
based on what's affordable. And certain courses, there's a compound out there called apigenin, which is £15 a month.
Okay.
And if that's where you're at, well, that's what we would do, alongside the best conventional therapy, alongside the dietetics, the lifestyle, the psychospiritual, and the exercise programs, all of which have got evidence of efficacy.
Hmm. Well, look, that's interesting. And do I take it, I mean, you listed off quite a few things there that you could be looking at, which are moderately priced and you can rotate. Are the those ones that are coming up as being most likely to help the most people?
Yes. Well, what did I say? If you were to ask me which ones do I find myself prescribing the most from the RGCC test? I would certainly say vitamin C is probably up there for those that wish to afford,
okay,
or can afford. There, Artemisia, and there are different types, but there are three different types tested. This doesn't mean it's different Artemisia, but it's different extracts and processes of extraction. And it would appear that there are different factions and compounds within Artemisia that have different effects on being cytotoxic, which is why different compounds come up with different benefits or different percentage benefits. Agaricus blazomurum is quite frequent. It seems to turn up along with genistein, which is a plant extract that works as a growth blocker, because it works theoretically along the lines of tamoxifen as an estrogen blocker. Mm. Convolvulus, bindweed, shows up. It works in both ways, both as a cytotoxic and as a growth factor inhibitor. We certainly see curcumin and quercetin coming up a lot. Curcumin is so well researched in laboratories and animal studies that the fact that it hasn't been researched more as a mainline chemotherapeutic agent is purely down to commercial interests. Those would be my shallow end off the top of my head, and certainly vitamin D shows up very frequently, but there's about a dozen, I would say, that show up. And it's interesting that they show up in all cancers. Mm. There are a couple that are more common in female cancers, those that are estrogenic, certainly a couple that show up in prostate cancer for men. But whether somebody has a colon cancer, a lung cancer, renal cancer, there does seem to be a dozen top dogs, yes.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting to hear. So this is where, if you like, the people who can't afford the test are actually benefiting from the people who can, in as much as this information is being found out, that these are the most widely applicable natural methods. And so, again, it's a way of narrowing down their choices somewhat.
Yes, absolutely. Mm. And interestingly, perhaps, this is the way that most medicine seems to get to the market. Not necessarily even medicine, just therapy. Keyhole surgery started in the private sector. Mm. And people were paying a lot of money because of very few people doing it.
Right.
And those people went on to teach. And keyhole surgery is now widespread and preferable to open surgery. Right. It starts by those people who can affording, and then the benefits trickle down, right, or up, depending on your political view.
Right. Interesting. So look, Dolshan, we started out with a list of two things to talk about today, and we're not doing very well with the list, but I'm not really going to apologise, because we've had such an interesting talk about this testing, which is, there's so much to it, and it's such an important topic. We have barely mentioned the heat shock proteins that we're going to talk about, but we've pretty much run out of time, so really... maybe you just want to say a couple of sentences which are going to whet people's appetite for the next show that we're going to do about heat shock proteins.
Yeah, we can certainly do that. It's a much shorter topic, of course. Heat shock proteins are found in all cells, both plant and animal. I say all cells. There may be some cells out there, mammalian or otherwise, reptilian or plant, that don't have them. But heat shock proteins are proteins that mop up heat. They have other functions, which we'd be able to discuss more. But if you can watch a pan boiling and pop in your two boiled eggs, mm-hmm, you'll notice that for a few moments, the bubbling diminishes.
Right.
The water levels off. And then after a few moments, the bubbles start to arise and the water becomes agitated once again. This is because the heat in the water was absorbed into the egg, and it continues to be absorbed depending on whether you like your eggs runny or hard.
Right.
The point is that the egg is acting like a heat shock protein by absorbing the heat. These heat shock proteins, if they are abundant, allow us to travel across a desert with less trouble than somebody who has less heat shock protein within their cells. So if a cancer cell, which is multiplying rapidly, constantly deforming its DNA when it does so, if the heat shock protein genes become distorted and dysfunctional, then the heat shock protein resistance diminishes. So as cancer cells can be tested for some specific heat shock proteins that are relevant to cancer, we can determine whether if we heat up the body, the cancer cells will actually not tolerate it. So much like sending two people into the desert, one who's got a lot of heat shock protein, one who doesn't, the one who does will survive. And what the hope is that heating an individual, therefore the basis of thermotherapies, we are able to inhibit the cancer cell. However, there are other aspects, which, as you say, we can discuss at some other point, whereby the heat, the lack of protection against the heat changes the cell, allowing certain treatments to be more effective. But so, that's a longer story.
So this is the science behind treatments such as hypothermia. So very interesting. I would love to go into it some more, and we will. So, look, it's been a fascinating talk today. Thank you very much, Dr. Sharma, and I'm looking forward to talking more.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. Bye.
All right, bye-bye. Well, I hope there weren't too many of you hanging in there for the heat shock protein discussion, but I promise I will get back to this after Christmas, and I'll add another topic of interest alongside it. Another reminder to book your place at the Yes to Life conference on nutritional science and cancer before relaxing into your Christmas break, otherwise you might just find yourself unable to get a seat next year. Also, very importantly, we're launching The Big Week Off on the 12th of January, a New Year detox fundraiser. If you've ever thought of detoxing, then this could be your chance to try it safely. Look on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and on social media under the hashtag The Big Week Off to find out more. And also check back in here on the Yes to Life show, as Liz Butler of Your Healing Heart will be on the show. Liz has developed the detox programs and will be introducing the aims and aspirations of the challenge. Very best wishes to you for your Christmas. Next week will be the last show of 2019, so I hope you can join me again here on UK Health Radio. Thanks for listening today. Goodbye. Thank you.